Right, although as many other people, my title has changed a little bit, so. Actually, I decided to use the following title instead to concentrate on it. Right. Okay, so I decided actually to change the title a little bit and focus on a slightly different aspect of the problem and to talk about entropy and the second law in turbulence theory. So this is going to be a talk that is mainly out of the Kolmogorov of light. I won't be really discussing here scaling or intermittency or singularities or anything of that sort. That's a different part of the elephant. I mean, it does come in at some point, and I may even mention that a little bit, but I mean, I wanted to try to focus on some slightly different part of the physics of turbulence. Now, to justify this, of course, I have to appeal to some authority besides Kolmogorov, so I actually found a nice quotation of von Karman that I wanted to start with. Unfortunately, although I thought I brought it to Los Alamos with me, I left it in Tucson. And so I recovered it from my memory as well as I can. So when this is officially posted on the web, about a month from now, when I'm back in Tucson, I'll give the proper quote. But this is a fair representation of it. So this actually is something I found 2 years ago in CTR when I was browsing through their library. And this was from a early 50s paper of von Karman in a Air Force symposium. And he said, in turbulent flow, we see the tendency not only towards randomness, but a tendency towards some order. And he says, in the kinetic theory of gases, we may explain the approach to a final state by the Boltzmann principle and the second law, but for turbulent flow, the proper notion of entropy has not been found. We regard this as a fundamental problem in the foundation of statistical mechanics. So that's a fair paraphrase of what he stated. And he had in mind, for example, something like the flows that Charlie was showing, where you actually will set up some kind of mean velocity profile, and if you make some perturbation away from that, well, you'll return to it. There's a kind of statistical stability in the problem, and he was saying this is actually very reminiscent of what we see in kinetic theory of gases, where the equilibrium state is a global attractor, and one would like to understand that from the point of view of the second law. Now, there's been some work on trying to understand this sort of thing. One paper in particular, a famous one by Edwards and McComb, entitled Statistical Mechanics Far from Equilibrium, actually explored the role of entropy in turbulence theory. And they had this little quote there in which they said, well, the state of turbulence is in some sense the most chaotic one. They were sort of promulgating this notion of Bob Creighton about maximal randomness at the time. But then they attempted to use entropy, and they pointed out, well, in fact, the concept of entropy, when interpreted as information, is available for any system without reference to equilibrium. And I want to pursue that notion a little bit. In fact, to some degree, what I'm going to be giving here is what I consider a slightly updated version of the things that they considered in this paper, because I don't believe they got it quite right. Whereas I believe that what is correct is pretty simple. I don't think there's going to be much disagreement about it here, and one of my purposes is to find out about that, whether there's any disagreement, okay? Because I think it looks to me rather straightforward. Okay, so let's just say what the framework is. Actually, it's very similar to the kinds of things that Charlie was talking about earlier, with one minor difference. Our framework, of course, is we're going to start off with the Navier-Stokes equation. This could be an infinite space, or it could be in a bounded domain. And we can take the Navier-Stokes equation and have a forcing term in it, which might have a mean part, which includes like body forces or an external pressure head. We could also drive from the boundaries. But there's one thing that I want to add in particular, which is the molecular noise, at least. So you may actually have an artificial problem where you're going to drive the system with some external random force at the large scales. That's to mimic a realistic driving. But that's not what I have in mind particularly here. I really have in mind here, in particular, that there's always molecular noise. And one thing that I want to emphasize is that we know exactly what the forcing of molecular noise is. It's given by a fluctuation-dissipation relation. And exactly the same viscosity appears here as appears there. Okay, so that's the fluctuation-dissipation relation for the molecular noise. It's really not consistent from a physical point of view to drop this term because it has exactly the same origin as that term. Now you can consider the limit in which they both go to zero. That would be the high Reynolds number limit. But in principle, from the physical point of view, they're really both there. And so I'm going to actually start off taking this as my basic framework, okay, that we are going to include the molecular noise. It's inevitably there from a physical point of view. Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, this is the same projection that appeared in Peter's talk. This is the projection onto incompressible solenoidal velocity fields. Okay, so this is going to be a Gaussian force. It is usually modeled as being white noise in time. And then this is also a solenoidal thing, so it's divergence free. So this is, this. Well, I mean, KBT may be small or large. I'm not going to assume anything about smallness of the temperature. This is just the standard model of molecular noise that everyone uses. Oh, you're saying that it would vanish relative if the temperature were going to zero. Well, it depends on what you mean by negligible, of course, because if you wait long enough, it will contribute. And in particular, if you're interested in steady state statistical behavior, then that force will play a role. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. At least we don't disagree yet. Okay. I hope so. Actually, I don't think what I'm going to say here is very controversial. We'll find out. Okay. No, okay. Okay, so now, from the physical point of view, if you're rather heuristic, it's not hard to derive the following type of equation. In fact, this equation appeared also in the Edwards-McComb paper. Just you write down the Fokker-Planck equation for this problem. So this is exactly the same setup that Edwards and McComb considered. They did it in Fourier space. They were considering periodic boundary conditions. That's not so important. We're going to do it in physical space. There are even rigorous versions of these types of equations that go back to Foyas and others, although they usually work with the Hopf equation for the characteristic function. This sort of equation has some reasonable mathematical pedigree if one does things carefully. So it's just the standard Fokker-Planck equation where, of course, to remember the notations, this A term is the same, it's just the drift term, the deterministic part of the Langevin equation right there. And then the diffusion term in this equation, so this is a parabolic equation in a big space, a functional space in some sense, is just the covariance, the spatial covariance of the noise. Okay, so it's just the standard Fokker-Planck equation. Pardon? Oh, I could do that too, yes. That would be a multimedia presentation. Well, of course, in this case, it's completely justified because I had a Langevin equation that I started off with. So, I mean, there's no real truncation. This is just the standard Fokker-Planck equation. It's equivalent to the Langevin equation that I wrote down on the first slide. There was no real truncation. Of course, you could say, to what extent is this first equation valid? And in that case, you're assuming some separation between the microscopic, you know, atomic scale and the usual hydrodynamic scale, but that seems fairly reasonable. Okay. Okay, now, of course, there are some mathematical issues that I'm going to finesse away by, you know, giving serious meaning to this kind of stochastic partial differential equation is not a totally trivial enterprise. Physicists usually adopt a rather pragmatic attitude that, well, after all, you really want to take this and, say, in Fourier space, truncate at some high wave number, which represents like the inverse of some intermediate length scale, or like here, you would coarse grain this system. You would think these represent coarse grain variables where the coarse graining is at some scale intermediate between the hydrodynamic scale and the atomic scale. So these are still fluctuating variables, but they're not going all the way down to the continuum. Okay, so I'll adopt such a rather pragmatic attitude towards this and assume that this is, for example, on some lattice where everything actually now just becomes an ordinary, actually a partial differential equation, not a functional partial differential equation, just to finesse. So I can avoid some of the trickier mathematical issues with the stochastic partial differential equations or this big functional differential equation. Okay, so nothing fairly controversial so far, I hope. So that's my framework. Okay, so anybody disagree with that? A is exactly over here. It is this thing. It's basically the acceleration. It's the systematic part of the acceleration. Of course, you also have a fluctuating part, but it's the systematic part. Okay. So again, this is exactly what appeared in the work of Edwards and McComb. They wrote down the same Fokker-Planck equation. Now, they then proceeded to try to apply entropy ideas to this problem. And what they looked at was the standard entropy, log rho times rho, and then you integrate over the phase space. That part, I don't think, has a very good basis for this kind of problem. What I would like to say rather simply is what does have a basis for this kind of problem, and there are many people here like Charlie and others that have done a lot of work with Fokker-Planck equations that know what I'm about to say very well. So there actually shouldn't be anything very controversial or surprising in what I'm about to say. The correct entropy for this kind of problem is not just the usual Gibbs entropy. The correct type of entropy for this problem is what's called the relative entropy. So if you actually take any two solutions of this big monster equation that I wrote down, any two solutions, it doesn't really matter what they are, then you can define this concept of relative entropy, where you take the ratio, actually, I mean, I'm thinking of these as being densities now, so I have to be a little careful. I really should have D's here. These are like Radom-Nikodym derivatives. So I'm being a little waffling in my notation here. Here I'm thinking of these as being densities. If I think of these as being densities, well, then I should really have a PT times a DX or a DV, some functional derivative over a velocity space. Or else I could think of these as being measures, in which case I should have a D there. Then that's a Radom-Nikodym derivative. But in any case, this is up to notational things, just the standard definition of relative entropy. And it's easy to see. This is trivial, just Jensen's inequality. This is a non-negative convex functional of P of T, the first argument. And it's zero only if P of T is equal to Q of T. Well, why not? Sure, you give me PT and I tell you how to calculate this, so it's a function of PT. Yeah, why not? Sure, it's a functional, of course, yeah. Okay, so this is the standard concept of relative entropy. Now, it's well known in the theory of Fokker-Planck equations that there's an H theorem in this general context. If you take this derivative, it's just a simple calculation that you get the following equality, and since this covariance is positive, this is always less than or equal to zero. So what this really tells you is that solutions, any two solutions, become closer together. Okay, so they have a tendency to approach each other. Now, in particular, if there is a unique invariant measure, and I'm going to assume that now. So I'm going to assume that this system has a unique invariant measure. It might not be true, but let's assume that, in fact, there is one unique invariant measure. Then you can define an entropy relative to that unique invariant measure. And then, of course, there is the tendency for this positive function to decrease down to zero towards this invariant measure. So this is just expressing the tendency to relax back to this equilibrium Q star, which of course is not a thermodynamic equilibrium, it's something far from equilibrium. But there's nothing in, as Edwards and McComb pointed out, there's nothing that really depends on being thermodynamic equilibrium, all this is completely general. Okay? So in that case, the two solutions would become close to one another just because they're all becoming close to Q star. Okay? Nothing controversial so far. Of course, yeah, that's, of course, when you take the derivatives, remember that, when you took the derivatives, these are both solutions, and so the A's and the F's and so forth disappear in there. That's what allows you to get rid of sort of the drift term that would naively be there. Okay? Now, there are some subtleties already, because, of course, we know that this term here does depend on nu, And for the turbidence problem, we might actually like it if our H theorem was sort of Reynolds number independent. Now that, of course, is going to involve the same kind of subtle issues involved in the kind of thing that Charlie was talking about in terms of dissipation. Because we know, well, right, let's say we believe generally, according to the conventional phenomenology, that as you let viscosity go to zero, the dissipation tends to a finite limit. Similarly, when you let viscosity go to zero, we have this molecular noise. You should also still get some effective turbidant noise, which doesn't depend on the molecular noise. I mean, I like this pregnant phrase of Harvey Rose, who talked about not just eddy viscosity, but there's also eddy noise. Okay, so turbidence generates its own noise. These two things are intrinsically linked together. Whenever you have dissipation, you also have fluctuations, the fluctuation-dissipation relation. And so as you let viscosity, molecular viscosity, go to zero, you should, in fact, have not just an effective dissipation, but also still an effective noise. I mean, for strongly hyperbolic systems, I mean, I guess you could take a rigorous example. This would be like what you see in axiom A systems, where you can add a little bit of noise, and you use that to select out an appropriate measure. Pardon? Well, Well, of course, you're right, of course. The fact that I have some non-degenerate noise here is going to ensure that I've got something unique as a steady state for this perturbed problem, and it's not at all clear for the original hyperbolic problem that I posed. I mean, I simply assume that, and who knows? Okay. So far we don't disagree. Okay. Now, I mean, let me just try to convince people, since this is not the entropy that physicists like Edwards and McComb consider natural, let me just talk about this entropy a little bit and say why I think it actually is sort of the reasonable, correct entropy to look at for this problem. Actually, if you look at this entropy, it has all the standard connections that you would like. For example, we know from Boltzmann's principle in equilibrium statistical mechanics that there's a connection between entropy and fluctuations. If you want to know the cost to observe a fluctuation, you just exponentiate the entropy for that fluctuation. The same thing is actually true here. There is a connection between entropy and fluctuations. There are various ways of saying this, but here is sort of a simple example of how the principle would hold. Suppose that you actually did an experiment in which you chose n samples independently from a certain distribution Q of t on the velocity fields. Well, then, analogous to Boltzmann's principle, if you said, okay, I want to know what is the probability that this sample average differs from the ensemble average with respect to this measure Q of t, the probability of observing such a fluctuation event V is just given by the entropy, where what you do is you take the minimum over all the measures P whose averages give you that particular velocity field that you're interested in. You minimize this guy over all those. That's this sort of reduced entropy that appears here. And that's the entropy that appears there. So this is like the maximum entropy principle. You have to understand that I'm sort of taking Boltzmann's original conventions. That's why I always write this as H. So instead of maximizing entropy, we now minimize it because there's a sign difference, right? That's why I also have a minus sign here, which is the way Boltzmann already did it, which is actually, from the mathematical point of view, a lot more reasonable. But then, you know, unfortunately, the conventions of entropy were set before Boltzmann. So to relate H, you have to put an H and S, you have to put a minus sign. Okay, so there's nothing very complicated so far. I don't think there's going to be anything in this talk that's very complicated. Okay, now, you can also get this entropy another way, which is actually closer to the spirit of what people do in statistical physics and equilibrium. You can actually define the analog of a free energy. And to do that, you simply take your reference measure, you put in an exponential modification of it. So this is like a chemical potential type term. And that defines your free energy functional, and the Legendre transform of that is this entropy. Okay, so it's very much like equilibrium statistical mechanics, although we're very far from equilibrium. Okay, so There's also a connection of entropy and variational principles, just like in equilibrium. This is actually what was originally part of the title of the talk. If I want to get the ensemble average of my velocity field, then to do that, you can actually minimize this. So if I would minimize my entropy over all the possible velocity fields, that minimum is achieved precisely at the ensemble average. Okay, so these are, again, just very well-known standard features of the relative entropy. There's actually nothing very non-trivial here at all. As a generating functional, okay, well, also we know that in thermodynamic equilibrium, you can get correlation functions from the entropy. That's also true here. If you want to get the cumulants, those are actually generated by this quantity F. So I'm using an abbreviated notation here in which I have the derivatives with respect to lambda at the point lambda equals zero just give the cumulants of the velocity field. If I want to get what are called the irreducible correlation functions, or the vertices sometimes, those are generated by this entropy function. Okay? Now, this actually appears a little bit like what people, I don't know if there are any field theorists in the audience, I mean, it seems like all our field theorists have disappeared, but anyways, field theorists actually might recognize this as a little familiar. It's actually very similar to what happens in field theory, where you have a cumulant generating functional to generate the connected functions, and then you have an action functional to generate the irreducible functions. This is actually a connection which can be made a little more precise. Okay, so let me just say more precisely what the connection is. Here also, in this context, you can define an action as well as an entropy. So in field theory, you would define such a cumulant generating functional where, let's say what this is now, this curly Q is a path measure over histories. So we take our stochastic equation that we started with over here. We now start off with some random initial conditions, Q0. That generates a path measure over our histories, and that's what this curly Q is. So now I'm looking at space-time histories of the velocity field. Well, from that, I can define this cumulant generating function, W of H, and the effective action is a Legendre transform of that. Okay, so this is just what everyone does in quantum field theory in particular. And so now this guy will generate the connected Green's functions, and this guy will generate the irreducible Green's functions of your problem. Now, there's actually a nice, interesting connection between this object and between the entropy, and that is the following. If I take this functional gamma, the action, which is now a functional on space-time histories, and I minimize it over all possible histories that at the time t take on the given velocity field v, then it's, again, not hard at all to show that this just recovers the entropy. Okay? People that know some statistical physics might recognize that this is very similar to a relation that was demonstrated by Ansager and Machlup in equilibrium in their 1953 paper. So Ansager and Machlup had shown in their 1953 paper that there is an analogous action principle in statistical mechanics for determining probabilities of histories. And in that case, if you want to know the probability of observing a given history, then you have to exponentiate the time-integrated dissipation function. And that serves for histories exactly the same role as the entropy does for a single time fluctuation. Furthermore, they showed that if you minimize this time-integrated dissipation function over the whole past, subject to such a constraint as this, you recover the ordinary entropy. Okay, so this same kind of relationship holds here. Okay, so this Ansager-Machlup type principle is in fact just another simple, in fact I regard it as sort of the most elegant manifestation of the fluctuation-dissipation relation. Okay, so in fact also in this general setup there is in fact a connection between entropy and action. Those are simple results. Okay, now, I would like to now connect this with some of the stuff that I've been doing. I mean, why have I been thinking about the second law? Well, I think I'm going to try to convince people that there are a number of reasons that one might be interested in thinking about the second law. It's appeared in some of my own recent work, And that's what I'm going to talk about next. I've sort of been forced to realize that the second law does play some relatively important role in trying to predict some of these turbulence properties. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about some of the efforts I've been making trying to calculate the effect of action. This is just one of the possible ways that you might try to calculate the effect of action. I mean, it contains a lot of information in it. If you can calculate the effect of action, it gives you temporal time correlation functions, so you can address things like dynamic scaling, for example. It actually gives you variational principles. There are lots of interesting reasons to try to calculate it, and there are many ways you could try to calculate it. This particular method was borrowed from field theory, so it actually goes back. I mean, it was motivated by some work that Kerman and Jakeev did in 1979, in which they tried to calculate the effect of action for zero temperature, actually in not for the statistical problem at all, but at zero temperature in quantum field theory. But I mean, their particular theorem can actually be generalized, and the result is the following. It says that if you want to calculate this, you can actually calculate this effective action by doing a constrained minimization. Actually, not really a minimization, it's in general a saddle point, but I mean, it's actually a stationary point. What you do is you take this object, which is kind of a microscopic action, and you vary it over all possible measures and all possible observables subject to a constraint of unit overlap, and furthermore, you constrain this kind of expectation to be the given particular field configuration that you're interested in, and that result of that variation will be the effective action at that particular V that you've chosen. Okay, so this is actually a way of characterizing the effective action, which can be made the basis of approximate methods of calculating it by a Rayleigh-Ritz procedure. So in that kind of Rayleigh-Ritz procedure, you would actually choose an ansatz for your measure, okay, with some parameters in it. You would choose a corresponding set of observables characterized by another set of parameters A of T. Simplest thing, which is not necessary, but the simplest thing is simply to take a linear superposition of a corresponding set of moments. And then plugging that into this variational apparatus, you can actually, by now varying over these parameters M of T and A of T, get a Rayleigh-Ritz approximation to this. So I think in the quantum field theory, I mean, people have made actually subsequently some applications of this to non-equilibrium quantum field theory. In particular, Jakeev and his wife, Soo-Young P, have done some work along these lines. Most of that work has been using rather simple Gaussian ansatz for P. Okay, now one of the things I think that's since we're here at investigating the physics of turbulence, I think it's sort of nice to talk about ways that we can interact with some other physicists. And one thing I'd like to advertise about turbulence is that it's a wonderful non-equilibrium field theory problem. And a lot of other problems exist of this type. I mean, for example, there are other classical non-equilibrium field theories like phase ordering problems, spinodal decomposition, but also in terms of astrophysics, things like cosmology, early universe. There are lots of interesting problems where the quantum field theorists, for example, are facing the same kinds of difficulties. And turbulence is a wonderful opportunity to test the kinds of methods that people have been trying there, but in a situation where you really have some possibility of making experimental checks to see how good your theories really work. And of course, in the cosmological astrophysical context, the opportunities for making those tests are much more limited. Okay, so I think that's actually one good way of sort of interfacing with some of the rest of the physics community. Okay. Well, I mean, in fact, I mean, if you look at, for example, what there already was some work like that in quantum field theory, where you can do a sort of variation, not just at the level. Of course, I'm just looking here at sort of the simplest effective action, where you write down an effective action for the velocity field alone. But you could also look at for composite operators as well, or say the Green's function. And it's well known, I mean, this is actually old work of Cornwall and Jakeev and Tambulis, where you can get Hartree-Fock or DIA-type self-consistent equations within this framework, but you have to sort of generally go to the next order. You don't just look at the effective action for the mean field, but also for the second-order statistics as well. You know, then you could get DIA-type equations. No, but that's the whole point. The Rayleigh-Ritz is a non-perturbative technique. Right. Well, talk to Victor Yehud. What I'm saying here is I personally want to try. In terms of motivation, I was impressed by the kind of work that, say, Feynman did on superfluid helium spectrum. The Rayleigh-Ritz method is a very nice method where if you want to learn some simple physics, you can put in your guess of what you believe the statistics are and see if you can get out some reasonable predictions. So like, you know, what did Feynman do? They put in some simple ideas about vortices. They made a wave function ansatz. They plugged into the Rayleigh-Ritz apparatus, and what comes out is the roton dip in the superfluid spectrum. So it gives you some reasonable idea, well, okay, this kind of simple physics can produce the roton dip in the superfluid spectrum. I would advertise this Rayleigh-Ritz methodology here as for the same purpose. You can explore some simple physics, actually using the equations of motion, but, you know, putting in some physical intuition as well. And it's a non-perturbative technique. I mean, you know, in physics, we have relatively few methods that are really non-perturbative. And this one is an honest one in the sense that you're making all of your assumptions up front. You make some simple guess, you make some simple understanding of what you believe the physics is, and you want to confront your beliefs with the equations, and this is a way of doing that. Okay, how much time do I have? -3? Oh my. Okay, I didn't realize I was getting so close. Okay, let me just say quickly, if people are interested in seeing some of the applications I've made of this, I don't think we've made the most non-trivial applications yet, certainly not published, but, I mean, here are some things that I've done. Actually, this was two summers ago at CTR, where if you're interested to see how sort of putting relatively simple closure models into this Rayleigh-Ritz apparatus, how well you can do with two-time correlations, that's actually recorded here. I actually have a couple of copies of those papers with me in case anyone wants to really see that. I don't have time, obviously, to go into details here. Actually, another kind of application which the field theorists might find amusing is that actually these methods actually really have some practical importance. For example, they turn out to be very nice for doing things like inverse modeling or optimal estimation. So the situation might be there, for example, suppose you're in a hydrological context, which is maybe basically passive scalar. Essentially, the physics is the same. You want to say, okay, given that there was some contamination in the past, and you dug a well here, and then suddenly you see a big blip of say, radioactive material or some kind of industrial waste, what was the most likely source in the past of that contamination? Well, actually, this kind of variational principle that I'm talking about actually gives you a way of calculating such conditional statistics. In other words, not only can you calculate the unconditioned statistics by taking these variations, I mean, minimizing this action, but subject to constraints, you can calculate the conditional statistics. So this is actually something that we've actually tried to do in some simple models of climate dynamics where you're trying to estimate the past climate state. And in the particular model we're looking at, the standard methods for this failed, but this actually we've already demonstrated works quite nicely. Okay, I just want to say very quickly, and then I'll quit, what is the role of entropy in this? Because that actually turns out to be somewhat interesting. Okay, when you actually use this Rayleigh-Ritz approximation, it turns out that in general, to second order accuracy in calculating this, you actually get a nice version for the closure equation of the fluctuation dissipation relation. So when you calculate this to second order, or if you do an entropy, this is a little more complicated, but if you do a kind of entropy preserving closure, this is something I've been doing with Dave Leverdmore, these turn out to be exact to all orders, but you actually get an Onsager mock-up type form out of your Rayleigh-Ritz characterization of this action, and it turns out that the Q that appears here is the same Q that appears in your entropy law. So precisely this thing is positive and to quadratic order convex when this thing here is quadratic. And so it turns out that your Rayleigh-Ritz approximation turns out to be convex, which is a statistical realizability requirement, if and only if you preserve the second law. So in fact, if you want to get a good result in terms of this thing, it turns out that it's really important to preserving the second law of thermodynamics for your closure, that is, that you really have to have this thing decreasing. So this kind of statistical stability requirement here actually turns out to be important in getting good results here. This actually is somewhat helpful. I mean, I actually have been trying to do some fairly non-trivial closure calculations, for example, with Bob Krapschin's mapping closure, which puts in highly non-Gaussian ansatz. I mean, it's a very useful laboratory to actually play around with putting highly non-Gaussian ansatz. And the first result I got actually had this Q matrix being not positive but negative. So this thing actually was coming out negative when I put in the mapping closure. And what I realized was that the way I was doing the closure, I was also violating the second law of thermodynamics, which sort of told me how to correct the problem. So this particular connection has actually turned out to be a little useful in terms of diagnosing the failures of the closures. Okay, anyways, let me just make a quick conclusion. Okay, so this is a sort of my general moral that is what I've taken from my present work with the Rayleigh-Ritz stuff. Well, first of all, is that, as I said, turbulent flow is statistically stable. And that means that, say, the same averages will result for a large domain of initial data, or small perturbations will relax. And this H theorem that I wrote down does seem to be the correct mathematical representation of that kind of stability property. Now, if I want to sort of motivate this fluctuation-dissipation relation, I mean, the sort of the heuristic way to motivate it is say that fluctuation should have this, from average quantity, should have the same statistical tendency to relax as initial perturbations. It doesn't really know whether it arose as a fluctuation or as an initial perturbation. So it's plausible, at least, that the most probable fluctuations would exhibit the least dissipation. So my suspicion is that this kind of fluctuation-dissipation relation probably has a validity that goes beyond the Rayleigh-Ritz approximation. I mean, I can't say anything beyond that at the moment. That's what comes out of the Rayleigh-Ritz kind of calculation in general. But it smells to me that there's something a little more general here, and I think that's something that has to be investigated more in the future. Okay, so that's it.
Maybe just one question.
Okay. Oh, for the experimentalist. Well, of course, that comes, of course, from the concrete applications. In that sense, you can check, for example, as we did at CTR, things like the time correlations. So the question is, you know, can you actually predict? This is what I proposed, for example, for Russ Donnelly in his experiment, was to actually calculate, for example, the predicted two-time correlations that I had done with this Rayleigh-Ritz for the decay problem. That kind of thing can be checked experimentally. Right. What is this theorem telling you? Well, it's telling you that, as I think is sort of summarized in the last slide, is that the cost to observe a fluctuation is related to the dissipation required to produce that fluctuation. That's the essence of it. Now, I can't really tell an experimentalist, for example, how to measure this entropy. That might be something that would be interesting to understand. You can, of course, always do it by sitting in the flow and monitoring the fluctuations, but, of course, that's very different from the way we do it for experimentally in equilibrium. In equilibrium, you don't monitor fluctuations, so. Yes. Sure. Okay, so finally we reached a controversy. Of course, I didn't add the F tilde. I didn't add the F tilde, nature did, but well, Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, I would emphasize again, I am not adding F, you know, I am not adding F tilde. I mean, God added F tilde. Okay, so, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you also very low activity, much, much more, much, much smaller than the energy in the Hydrogen Bowl. I think we should cut here and continue because we still have a very good program with the other. So I'd like to ask Salih Sandhya to be the last question.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yes.